cause there's a reason to rejoice, you see.
Just listen to Power of Praise here on WEFT Champaign 9.1 FM on the dial for a brand new day.
WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and this is February the 18th, 2018, and this is the Prairie Monk Show, WAFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, conservation-related things, and whatever else has been coming up around here that Dave is aware of.
Well, one of my main things today is to discuss the interim trail use agreement with the Kickapoo Trail. There was a Forest Preserve meeting on Thursday. Forest Preserve is the agency that's been designated as in charge of the rail trail, and does a good job at that. My concern is the habitat that's on the trail and the width of the trail. So I was talking to some of the people involved, and it seems to me a fait accompli that the trail will be as wide as the first phase, which took out all the remnant prairie that was on either side of the bed. It wasn't helped by the fact that the road was expanded too, so that was nothing to do with the Forest Preserve, it was to do with the Department of Transportation. That has a potential in further phases too. But one of my concerns is that we're down to 0.01% of the remnant prairie that was here in the Grand Prairie. And when you do that, you have to be very careful about taking out the last of the Mohicans. It's there's all sorts of reasons for keeping a wide trail. There are all sorts of parties involved, but that doesn't make it right. When you're down to that small amount, you try to preserve. And the phase one is extremely popular, and it's doing well, and it's an economic value. Restaurants and other businesses will benefit from it. The property values will go up. It's a recreational experience that some people have not experienced before, and it can go back to railroading if necessary. Not likely to happen quickly, but that's the whole principle of the Rail Banking Act, was to have an agreement with local railroad beds that were being abandoned at a rapid rate to keep them. I want to emphasize the fact that when you're down to 0.01% of the remnants around, that is rather serious. This week we were listening to radio broadcasts that included the fact that orangutans have lost a huge amount of their territory and their species. In a matter of 16 years, the animals have been taken out for food, and the habitat is gone, and hunters are there. And so, there are other concerns, and so we have our concerns too. We have a prairie that's almost non-existent. And do you take it out? Do you have the moral right to take it out? So I'm after a narrower trail. If it's 10 feet wide, I'd prefer to have an 8 feet wide trail. Monticello has an 8 feet wide trail, and it does very well. It's also a popular trail. But there are other places where there are even narrower trails. But I wanted to say something. I was not, just for various good reasons, I arrived there late, but I was able to talk. One of the things that bothers me is the difference between a reconstructed prairie and a remnant prairie. A remnant prairie is what has been there when settlement occurred. It's not always happy that most of it is along railroad beds that are active or passive. Because there is creosote there, and there is on either side the farmland that contributes chemicals by drift or in actual fact, or in some farm invasion on either side. So what we have is pretty messed up. But it's, in many cases, it's the only prairie that locals are going to see in the future. If you take the prairie that's abandoning between Farmer City and Mansfield, to drive along that corridor and see the prairie there, it's probably what most people are only going to ever see. The reconstruction plots are numerous, and getting to tell people a little about what a prairie is. But the only native prairie that people are going to see is along that corridor, and others like it. It's been mown and mown and mown, and it has these invading chemicals, but that's the best we have. And I would like to see that continue. From experience with the first phase of the corridor, there's a move to really reconstruct that railroad bed. You take the rail off, you take the ties out, you then have some remnant creosote that many of these ties are 100 years old, so they're fairly well leached. But that is a concern. And there's usually an attempt, especially where there's an embankment, to take that leachate down the sides, and that takes out a lot of the prairie. There's also a feeling that rather than sit there with a backhoe and take out 3 inches of soil that still has under it prairie plants that have deep roots and adventitious buds that can come back, there's a tendency to take a bulldozer with a laser beam on it and run right along the sides for the whole length of the corridor. That means that you get a very disturbed soil, and if you do it in summer, you injure the plants that are there and it could be saved, and it's the drought time, and they're not going to grow and repair very well. It may be more expensive to sit on the side with a high hoe and take out 3 inches of soil, but if the order of the day is to take out a foot of soil, then take out a foot of soil and bring it back and leave the 3 inches that the plan says, then you're going to disturb the soil unnecessarily. And there's riprap on the side of the trail. So you have a 10-foot trail, but then you have riprap on either side that makes the trail wider. So then you cap the creosote with gravel or a bed. Often with EPA things, if you have a problem and it's localized, you're allowed to cap it with a cover, so that has to happen. Again, there's considerable disturbance to do that. Some of the plants can come back. You can restore the site, you can recreate a prairie. And I constantly get told that we can plant 80 different species in there, and that's even better than a remnant. Not exactly so. If you are trying to recreate a prairie, you can do it with 12 official plants, broadleaves, plus the grasses that grow fairly easily. You can go to 24 plants, 36 plants, 50 plants. But by the time you get up there, you're starting to get fairly sophisticated plants that would need special attention. You're selecting a very expensive seed. You can't just throw it out and hope it will work, because you're gradually beginning to have habitat that is very specific for different plants. And so if you throw out seed, it will eventually find a location if you're lucky. But not all of it will happen. And if you do it in summer, when there's typically a drought, it's not going to grow very easily. You're going to have to wait till the next season when it rains, and then probably germinates in spring and has to compete with the weeds that grow very quickly. You're also looking for associations. You don't always even have the research to know what sort of associations you would need. What goes with what insect or bacterium or biochemical goes with a rattlesnake master, for instance, or a hoary puccoon? How do you do that? Just to plant seed is not enough. You need the biological research to go with it. So how do we preserve some of the nature as nature before it is destroyed? Because we need the small examples that we have to tell us, to give us a guess as to what was here when settlement came. 94% of Champaign County was prairie. Most of that has been dug up is on farmland. And it's wall to wall. So the other 6% is on strange places like ditches and in corners where you couldn't turn a team of 10 horses around. And even those are going, because you can back a huge tractor right up into the corner and cultivate it for a few more stalks of corn and soybean. Let's look at the history of this. Heartland Pathways in the late 80s bought 33 miles of railroad bed in the Monticello area for three reasons. One was to preserve the rail corridor. That's in all our legal documents. The second was for a trail, so that people would see the prairie and get to know it and love it as a part of their heritage. And so you have rails, trails, and greenways. And the greenways, in our case, is prairie. We did that before there was a Rail Banking Act. Then there came to be a concern across the country that so many railroads were being abandoned that there was a not good opportunity for networking across the country, whether it be for military or for general railroading. So Congress put together a Rail Banking Act, and it was designed to preserve the dignity of railbeds. And how they were going to do this was to work with preservationists and trail people that were using these, buying these railroad beds. So that was a chance to make a deal. If you, the hikers, bikers, and habitat people were interested in buying this trail in an interim manner, you could save the railroad beds. And that was a considerable concern, because if you look at these railroad beds these days, if you go from St. Louis to Champaign-Urbana to Indianapolis, you're talking about a 100-foot wide corridor, sometimes less than that, sometimes more than that. If you go through small towns, it may be 200 feet wide. It may be wider than that because there may be a yard there. To come in, say, 100 years' time and buy that corridor back would cost you a fortune. Not only that, you have people who have sort of taken over the rail bed are going to have an extremely opposed concern for the rail being taken back. Whether that rail is for a local manufacturing that might go out from, say, Fulls Elevator to Champaign, if there was a factory on the side of the area, or it might be for national level connections like between St. Louis, Champaign-Urbana, and Indianapolis. The Rail Banking Act observed that the trail people were having problems, because when you put together a railroad, you make a deal with the people's territory that you move through. You can buy the bed with a warranty deed. That's a very good title. That means the railroad owns it, and they can sell it to anyone they like. It's their property. Then there are easements, and then the easement says, I'm a farmer. I'll lend you this railroad corridor until you decide to quit. Then I get it back. And there's various levels of that. And then there is adverse possession, where the railroad just said, oh, this is just 15 feet. Let's go across. We don't need to have a bunch of paralegals out there trying to debate this small piece. That's a adverse possession. And that goes back to the original owner. And then there are condemnations, where the judge said to the owner, we're going to do this because it's going to be for the benefit of the state and the nation that this railroad bed goes through your place, and we're going to give you a generous price for the land, but we're either going to buy it or we're going to, whatever, we're going to put the railroad through. Those people have the right to get that land back. What the Rail Banking Act did was to quiet those titles. So, in effect, they justify this to some extent because the public has put a lot of money into railroads. Even if they're privately owned, they're often supported by federal funds. Like if you look at the Illinois Central, which comes through Champaign-Urbana, the federal government assigned large areas to the railroads to sell off in order to put in the railroad. So there's a public commitment to this, whether it be in 1850s or later. So public domain was was okay. It's justifying this move. The second thing that the railroads do, according to federal mandate, that means that the feds are going to tell you that this bridge has to be removed because it can be a liability. And it's called a mandate. And it happens when the railroad is abandoned. So that was the second thing that the Rail Banking Act did, was save the bridges. And the third thing they did was to provide generous money, not for the purchase of the line. The locals had to buy the line. I think that probably was to justify their commitment. But they provided generous enhancement money to improve that corridor so it could be a legitimate trail. In the case of the Kickapoo Trail, that's $12 million. That may not be the whole story because you may have to spend more money than that to put in trailheads or seats along the way or restrooms or things like that. But basically, that's a fair bit of money. And the first phase between Banner and St. Joe was $3 million, a matter of 7 miles. And the bid was, the lowest bid was higher than expected, so the locals had to put in money to make that possible. The Rail Banking Act had to sort itself out around the real railroads. The first group of people that get the crack at an abandoning railroad is the railroad themselves. So in Danville, for instance, CSX was buying railroad beds and keeping some of them afloat with the rails on them. So it was entrepreneurial concern. Then you get the opportunity for a Rail Banking Act. And it is announced in the newspaper. You get a chance to look at this. The Rail Banking Act is administered by the Surface Transportation Board, which is more or less the federal government's transportation. You also have to have an agreement between the closing railroad and the agency like Heartland Pathways, which was going to buy the railroad bed. We felt that this, after having succeeded at purchasing and paying for in a timely manner the 33 miles in the Monticello area, we were aware of the value of the site. We'd watched the site for years because there are strip mines in Danville. Danville area has a very interesting geological background. It has faults and it has areas where vegetation accumulated eons of years ago and then was set over by various other constructs of geology, and that vegetation, Carboniferous age vegetation, was compressed into coal, and you can still go down there in the mine and see the plants that were there. They don't stay for very long because once you've taken out the provided oxygen access to the area, then those remnants start to decay. There's history there. There's in Danville, there's a rolling terrain also, and there's also the Vermilion River goes through there and enters into the Wabash. And there's strip mining that provided ponds. The idea of a strip mine is often to take a river where the ballast over the coal mining has already been removed. So it's much more cost effective to go into a river and take out your coal there. So what you do is you make a corridor to bypass the river, and you take out the coal, and then you put back the overburden, and then you do the same again. Once you finish that, you make a furrow and you turn over the overburden and make a strip. It's called strip mining. And you can see it in Danville. You can stand there and look at rows and rows of strips of the mining. So you have ponds that are 15 years old, 25 years old, 75 years old, and it's a wonderful place for a biologist to go in and look at those ponds. The early pond will have some sulfur. The overburden taken out often has a orangey tinge to it. It would indicate that there's sulfur in there, and so it doesn't grow back naturally very easily. You often start off with bloodworms and creatures that can handle that particular paradigm, and then gradually it will return to normal, in inverted commas. It's going to be slow. So you go from a lot of one creature to many of a few creatures. And gradually, we would go over there with a clam. You would put it down into the very black material that is the result of early restoration of ponds. And you could pull up the muck and then strain it out and find what organisms are there. So this is a sort of a biological research area of note. It is also, the terrain is various. The Indians would, or the Native Americans would be there in the winter especially. In the summer they may range out into Champaign County where it's flat but fertile and grow vegetables and hunt animals and use those little places like Busey Woods or Brownfield Woods where there's been an esker underneath a glacier that provides a place for rest and resuscitation. You can find the glacial till that came from the Laurentian Shield in Canada, and you can find ways to make arrowheads and leave them as a cache at one place so that you may go back to Danville and in the winter and come back and find those again. You might even be able to trade, so that in some cases those arrowheads are obsidian that comes from a different place. So we know that there was trade. You had whole societies like the Cahokia Mounds and the extension north and west. You don't even know why it didn't continue in the long run. And then you have this sort of history. And so the corridor is interesting. And it's an escape for Champaign County. People in Champaign County, many of them have little A-frame getaways for the weekend in Vermilion County or in Piatt County or in DeWitt County. So we use those other counties. So this particular railroad between Danville and Champaign-Urbana was to close out. Some of it was to be reused or kept. The Fool's Elevator wanted to retain the rails as active between Fool's and Mayview and into Champaign-Urbana to take out grain. Didn't work out that way because by this time you had an interurban next door. The main line would have been established probably in the 1850s or perhaps even after 1860s. It was early on and steam. The interurban came in after electricity had been sorted out, and it was a little tram track. It was parallel to the main line, and it was probably one or two cars. The rails were much lighter, whereas you might have a 135-pound rail for the main line. You may have a 69-pound rail for the interurban. But the electricity that ran the trains then began to be provided to the communities through which it ran. So you have this main line paralleled with an electrified IT, Illinois Traction Company. And it sometimes took freight. If you go to Route 9, I think it is, at Fithian, you'll see that the elevator is designed so that the interurban could take out grain onto the interurban. They would have sometimes a slug. A slug was a car that generated its own electricity so that it could run the train. So you'd have a motor that ran the slug. You didn't dare to put 100-ton cars on there. It was a lightweight line. Sometimes it would convert onto the main line and get out that way. So we have these little pieces of history here and there. And the interurban, for instance, has a rather wonderful depot at Fithian, which has been preserved. The two lines together make for a little bit of preservation of the habitat. So go back to thinking about the newspaper ad that said or asked if anyone wanted to buy this bed as an interim trail. There's a deadline. We proselytized, and other people proselytized, all the local agencies that might be involved. None would take any opportunity to do this, mortally afraid that they would not get the money to buy the bed. We had that confidence because we had already bought without the help of the Rail Banking Act, and we felt the importance of this trail was such that someone needed to do something. So by default, Heartland Pathways is not necessarily a forest preserve or a nature conservancy or whatever. It took out an interim trail use agreement between Conrail, the abandoning trail rail, and Surface Transportation Board, which is the official federal surface transportation agency for the federal government, and ourselves. We were given time to acquire the money to buy the line, when we started this, we had no support money. So we were negotiating for a price for the whole bed. Later the bed was indeed has been acquired, but it's not for the whole bed. It's for parts of it. Or the main train track is been purchased, but there's those areas where he goes more through small towns like St. Joe, they buying the company that eventually bought the bed would use that as a real estate area for themselves and not included in the trail. Sometimes those sites are used by the rail-to-trail movement to help to pay for the associated trail. So that's not happening in the case of the Kickapoo Trail. So we were negotiating, and the most difficult part of the negotiation was for a bridge over the Union Pacific that comes through just east of St. Joe. It was put in after the main line, but even so, we were in discussion with probably best part of 15 attorneys for Union Pacific to see what we would have to do to take a bridge over that railroad bed. We figured it probably would cost about $70,000 to even look at taking a bridge there. It's a place where Union Pacific has two tracks so that the trains can pass or park, and they have the room to have a third track, and they'd like to have that there for future possibilities. This is one of those tracks that the railroad people are concerned about now because they are fairly heavily into intermodal trains where the trains are loaded by shipping containers, and the train itself never discombobulates. You don't take the trucks apart and send them in a different direction. We still have the traditional manifest trains where you do push them together, one truck at a time. But the big movement is to have intermodal trains moving from San Francisco or Los Angeles to Chicago to New York to from Chicago to Memphis to New Orleans. These are major lines. So we had a lot of debate about how to get I-beams that would cover bridge, not only three lines, but the height of double-dumped intermodal trains. We hadn't finished that when other things happened. First of all, we went looking for funds. We went first to the cities involved, and we had the footprints for support, because this was indeed a good idea. And many people thought so. We went to the Champaign Design and Conservation Corporation, which does some interesting things in early, probably the 60s. Susan Stone and Natalie Alpert got together, and these were people who were interested. Susan was on the Urbana Park District Board, and Natalie Alpert was a professor in landscape architecture. And they got together and they created an organization that they thought ought to look after the landscape. And so there it is. It's the Champaign Design and Conservation foundation. It's a foundation, and it provides trees. It supports waterways. It does a lot of things that we're beholden for. It's in vernacular called CCDC, or CCDCF, and you put the foundation on the end of it. It's a legal body, and it's been active over the years. We went to CCDC for perhaps $5,000 or whatever they could afford toward the purchase of the line. And CCDC felt, and the Urbana Park District felt, this was a very useful thing to do, and was right within their mission. So they asked if they could be a party to our formal application to, or an acceptance of, we were documented by that time. So we made the moves to allow CCDC to be partners in this event. And we did partner. People don't understand it, but when you have 30 miles of railroad bed, you have to watch it, because it gets invaded here and there. It's not always understood. It's an empty rail bed, and you can park your cars on it and things like that. So it needs to be surveilled. You don't want it dug up across the corridor. And you also have to watch the resources. The bridges are interesting, but they're high. And people can't go and visit them easily because they're not used to the height. So what we would do is, first of all, when the rails were taken up, I actually rode in the cab of the train that took the rails up. It was interesting. The train starts out at a banner, and it moves about a quarter of a mile, and then it has like 10 or 20 flatbed cars behind it, and it they've taken out the spikes and the plates, but it's just enough to keep the train can move over it without derailing. And then that trail is about a quarter of a mile of railroad steel is lifted up, and sort of like a ringer, it's put along the flatbeds. And there's lots of creaking and groaning, but that bed will be loaded 1/4 of a mile at a time. The engine moves along and takes up and loads the track that it just rode on onto the back of its train. There's usually a few empty cars between the engine and the rails, just in case when they take this train load of steel to have its its stick rail held together by bolts. And what it is usually re-railed, especially the main line here was about 135-pound steel. It was valuable steel. So they decapitate the pieces that where they joined the sticks. Stick rail is about 33 feet long. You chop that off and you weld the rail together, and that welded rail is brought back to 1/4 mile at a time, back to sites where rail is needed. It might not be to this site, it'll be to another site where industry needs it, or where an old railroad is being upgraded from stick to welded rail. So this was a major effort. After the rails are removed, perhaps I should explain why the extra cars were put between the rails and the cab of the engine, was that if you were in a tight situation where you had to brake quickly, the momentum of that steel behind you could go right through your cab. So there's a buffer zone of to stop that from happening. There's also little sidelines that have to be taken out. The plates that were under the rail have to be lifted out and salvaged. They may be used, reused. So at St. Joe and Ogden especially, there were piles of ties and spikes and plates. The ties are usually plowed out and pushed to the side. So then semi-trailers come along, and you have a trailer that is called I'm trying to remember his name, but it's got a little crane on the back. So you sit on that and you take these ties up and put them onto the back of a rail bed.
8 minutes.
So those ties get judged. Some will be relayed. Some will be will be used for conservation, and some will be rejected. So we did that. We inserted rail ties between bridge ties, so that people wouldn't freak out when they were going across the a bridge. We also put wooden plug hole plugs in all the bridge tie holes. So where all the spikes were, we put a plug so that the bridge tie wouldn't rot because water got in the hole. And so it was quite a bit of work and quite a little bit of money to take a pickup truck back and forth along that corridor. CCDC decided they wanted to take over this, and they did. And so we kept doing the surveillance and work on the line, but it was obvious that CCDC wanted to do the fundraising. They were a foundation, and they felt that they could do this. They even decided that we were in conflict, because we wanted a rail authority which would have 7 or 9 board members and a CEO, and that would allow for a range of people to be involved. And this is part of the problem as to why I went was talking to the Forest Preserve people, because they didn't want that sort of breadth of involvement. They wanted to work with established agencies like the Forest Preserve. So I don't have much time, but unfortunately, CCDC did not get the money to buy the line in time. So CSX was lucky. It bought the line, and theoretically, it wouldn't have had the bridges unless we had saved them by taking out an interim trail use agreement. There's always agreements made that are different. But basically, you were supposed to save the bridges at the time of abandonment, which we did. And we caused the titles to be quieted. And we also made it possible for eventually to get enhancement money for the trail. Now, doing all that partially was we are in favor of saving the rails, because they're very economically useful. They don't use a lot of gas. 1 gallon of gas and a ton of freight, 500 miles. It's it's useful. So we're into, environmentally, we're into the rails. We're into the trails because we need the exercise and that opportunity. And we're into the prairie. So how do we get to do this? How do we talk to Surface Transportation Board, the Rail to Trails Movement, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the Illinois Department of Transportation, ASTO, the agency that is informally in control of some of the rules of the game, and whether you have, how do you work with EPA and ADA and things like that. There's people like the Grand Prairie Friends and the Audubon and others that would be interested locally. How do you get them into the same room at the same time? At the moment, we're being told from the Forest Reserve, after a very small amount of community action, we're being told that it's going to be a wide trail. My question is, when do we get into be in the same room and ask questions about what's happening? Often we can be on the same wavelengths, but be different. But we need to get together. I just went to a Vital Lands conference, and one of the main aims that they had there was get together in face to face and discuss these things. It's all right to have a quarter inch, half inch, 1 inch plan. But if that gets to be a fait accompli, it means you can't change it at all to preserve your remnant plants. So where do we get that opportunity? And it would seem that the mind has been made up. The trail is going to be 10 foot wide, and we have some pictures of what a 10-foot wide trail means. It means that you lose all the vegetation on either side. It can be replaced. You can always grow a tree or the trees will be coming out because there were no trees in this territory. They were all cruddy trees that have grown over 20 years. After 20 years, the process was reenacted, and the dockets that we formed became a part of the interim trail use agreement that is now in vogue. But we would like to ask, or beg, that the trail after St. Joe, from St. Joe to Ogden, be 2 feet narrower, just to give a little chance to the soil bacteria, the microorganisms, and all the little pieces of remnant prairie that are there on either side. And we have to continue to discuss that. We hope that you will take an interest in that too, because it's your remnant prairie. It's your 0.01% of what did our heritage prairie. It's getting to be the time. 1 minute. So think about how you talk to the Forest Preserve, and how do you get to talk to national and state level people who are doing this. It's a very, very popular procedure. We have had very few rail trails in central Illinois. We're losing one potential one between Paris and Decatur, which contains a lot of prairie. It's a moral issue between recreation and conservation of the nature along the trail. And we really are pushing for the narrow trail. And that may be conflictual, but that's okay. That's the name of the game. You're getting it. So this has been Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And as always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It's now noon. That means